Last week, I gave a sermon on the days of unleavened bread. And if you remember how I approached it, we looked at it, you know, beginning at the Old Testament, and we saw what it meant, and then we saw how it morphed, or how it changed, if you will, in the New Testament. And went through all that. I don't want to rehash all of that today. But, you know, last week we were in Sedgwick, and afterward, Mrs. Patello up there in Sedgwick came up to me, wanted to talk to me, and she said, you know, that was really interesting what you did with the days of unleavened bread. Doesn't the Passover work along the same lines where that you have a change in meaning and all of that? And she wanted to talk about all of that. And I had to stop her, and I had to tell her, come back for this week's sermon. Because that was exactly my thought process and all of it, and I decided to do the Passover this week because it is closer to the actual Passover. And so that's what we're going to do today. We're going to take a deeper dive into Passover. And so, Veranda, there in Sedgwick, consider this our continuation of the conversation we began last week. Now, when you say Passover to anyone out there in the world, to the average person, there are basically two different associations that come to their mind. The first one is that the Passover is an Old Testament celebration, and it was done away with by Jesus, and it's irrelevant to those that are considered New Testament believers. The second thing that you'll find from the average person is that the Passover is a celebration, is a holiday, if you will, that's limited just to the Jewish people. And it's not really, you know, meant for anyone outside their particular culture. And you look at it, both of those assumptions are wrong. The truth is that it was Jesus himself who put into place this new Passover service for his followers. And yes, there were Passover practices that had come from the Old Testament, and he did change those practices. And along the way, he gave us a brand new purpose for keeping the Passover. And so, if you will, he reoriented the focus of where we should be with Passover. And that focus, when you look at it, is game-changing for what he did. It pictured the event of his own sacrificial death. You had the death, you had the burial, you had the resurrection. And it had spiritual implications all the way then down through history to us today, here in 2022. Almost 2,000 years ago, he died. And so as we're going to see, the Passover is meant for us today. It's meant specifically for the followers of Jesus Christ. Now, the followers of Jesus Christ alive today, we don't base our beliefs on how we keep the Passover according to what's described in, as we'll see, in either Exodus or Deuteronomy. Those are different. Now, the Jews, to some extent, still follow, ceremonies to what they do today. But what we're going to see, that information is going to be helpful. It's meaningful, but it is not the basis for our modern observance. That's because we follow the example that Jesus Christ set. We follow those instructions that he gave us for what we do at Passover, for what we teach at Passover and about the Passover. How we then picture that with its spiritual implications, not just a physical celebration. The Passover that's described in Exodus and also in Deuteronomy has been fundamentally altered and changed by that historic reality of the death of Jesus Christ, his sacrifice for us. It was a game-changing event. And as such, then the Passover became the first one of the festivals in God's holy day plan. Now, as we see, and we'll go through and rehearse again, Jesus Christ is our Passover lamb. He's our high priest. He's that high priest of a new and a better covenant. We're told that in Hebrews. When Jesus and disciples, they gather for that final Passover, you have to remember, before Jesus changed the symbols, they kept the Passover the way the Jews had been keeping it for centuries. They shared together that meal that was loosely based on what you see in Exodus. before Christ actually changed the symbols. As we're going to see, there were additional elements that were added when we get to the book of Deuteronomy. And we see where Christ and the disciples, they kept that last Passover in Jerusalem according to the rules that were put in place in Deuteronomy, the place that God chose to put his name. They were eating lamb. And then it was at that evening meal that then afterward, Christ put forth these new practices. And what he did and what we'll rehearse today is he went through a whole new purpose, a whole new outlook on Passover. You know, I mentioned that Passover is described in Exodus and Deuteronomy, but you'll also see then again kind of a third iteration of that, and that's the one with the changes made by Christ. So what I'd like to do initially is to kind of go through and rehearse each one of these. The Passover as described in Exodus, the Passover as it's changed, tweaked, if you will, in Deuteronomy, and then finally look at the Passover that was instituted by Jesus Christ. You know, it's the new version, the New Testament version, that we need to focus on. You know, we're going to see is there is a thread, there is a commonality that runs through all of it. And of course that makes sense. So it behooves us, therefore, to understand the complete picture of Passover. So we'll begin with the Exodus Passover. And we've rehearsed this before. That Passover started with the nation of Israel coming out of the nation of Egypt. They were slaves in Egypt, and God brought them out. See, it's this model, that first model, that the Jewish population based their Passover observance on today. It forms the foundation. Now, they've gone through the centuries. They've added different things to it. And you'll see today, and you can, if you go to YouTube, you can actually see examples of the modern Jewish Seder. They call it a Seder meal. And it's got different aspects to it that are significantly different than what are described in the first Passover, but that's what the Jews use today. They have added plenty of non-biblical, if you will, traditions on top of it. But at its core, it is basically the thought and where it originally from was defined in Exodus. So for the Jews, what you see is that the Passover is this annual reminder, memorial of them, of their own national and cultural history. It's something that's very important to them that they hang on to. But to understand the roots of Exodus, you have to go back to Abraham. And so let's start there with Abraham, Genesis 12. Genesis 12, verses 1 through 4. So we're going to go even before what we see is the normal Exodus. Genesis 12, starting in verse 1. Now the Lord said to Abram, who would later become Abraham, and he said, "Get out of your country, from your family, from your father's house, to a land that I will show you. I will make you a great nation. I will bless you and make your name great. And you shall be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you. I will curse him who curses you. And in you all the families of the earth shall be blessed." And so he gives this. He said, "This is what I plan to do." And notice Abram's response. So Abram departed as the Lord had spoken to him, and Lot went with him. And Abram was 75 years old when he departed from Haran. So God appears to this man named Abram, and he's basically saying, I have an opportunity for you. And that opportunity was to create a nation. And, you know, not just any old nation. No, this was going to be a special nation. This was going to be a nation separate from all the other nations around them. See, this nation was to be created by God. This nation was to perform certain functions. They were to observe his laws, keep his commandments, his statutes. They were to preserve them. They were to pass these things along then to future generations. And when you look at it, this culture is what produced, you know, a suitable culture for the Christ, for Messiah. to which he could be born, to which he could be raised up, to which he could start the New Testament church. So you have a nation that was to be created by God, and they were to be separate, and they had a purpose. God has a plan. And this nation was to fill a vital role in that plan that he had set out. Let's go over a few chapters. Chapter 15, verses 18 through 21. Genesis 15, starting in verse 18. It says, on the same day, the Lord made a covenant with Abram. And see, a covenant again is just an agreement. So he's got this agreement with Abram saying, to your descendants I have given this land from the river of Egypt to the great river, the river Euphrates. Now, the Kenites, the Kenizzites, the Kadmonites, the Hittites, the Pezerites, the Rephaim, the Amorites, the Canaanites, the Girgashites, and the Jebusites, all the ites, if you will. So he's giving them this land. God said, here's my promise. I will give you all of this land. Because the nation needs land, doesn't it? It has to have territory. Go back up to verse 12. Verse 12 through 14. And it says, now when the sun was going down, a deep sleep fell upon Abram, and behold, horror and great darkness fell upon him. And he said to Abram, know certainly that your descendants will be strangers in a land that is not theirs. They will serve them, and they will afflict them for 400 years. And also the nation whom they serve I will judge. Afterward they shall come out with great possessions. A prophecy. And this is exactly what happened. What God is telling Abram is, before you go in, before I give you this land that I promised to you, he foretold for them that they would be foreigners in a strange land, that eventually they would become enslaved. Now, John Gill's commentary states this. He said the term 400 years is not to be joined with either the word afflict or to serve. For their hard servitude and severe affliction did not last that long. Rather, it belongs to the phrase, a stranger in a land that was not theirs. And so they weren't slaves for the entire 400 years, but they were foreigners in that land. So that's for 400 years. It's quite ominous, though, isn't it? I mean, God told Abram, I'm going to give you all this, but first, you're going to be strangers. You're going to be slaves. And there's going to be a period of, you know, of 400 years in which they're in that condition to be strangers. And then, you know, you go through the rest of the book of Genesis. It details that immediate family of Abraham. Talks about his sons, talks about his grandsons, talks about his great-grandsons, how they ended up in Egypt. And then that eventually led to their enslavement. Now, this prophecy was fulfilled through a man by the name, as we know, of Moses. And so Moses is commissioned by God to be this mediator between God, to be between them and the nation of Israel in their deliverance. And you go through Exodus, chapters 1 through 11, and it begins to tell the story, this commission of Moses, how God then judges the nation of Egypt. And he begins to perform all these plagues and everything. And it was a judgment that then culminated in that 10th plague, the plague of the death of every firstborn child and animal of the land. And so that's where we see the Exodus Passover. So now we're ready to go there. Exodus 12. Exodus 12, verses 1 through 6. Exodus 12 and verse 1. Said, the Lord spoke to Moses and Aaron in the land of Egypt, saying, this month shall be the beginning of months. It shall be the first month of the year to you. We talked about that several weeks ago. April the 2nd was the beginning of the Jewish New Year. And that's what he's talking about, that time. Verse 3, speak to the congregation of Israel, saying, on the 10th day of this month, every man shall take for himself a lamb, according to the house of his father, a lamb for a household. The household is too small for the lamb. Let him and his neighbor next to his house take it according to the number of persons. According to each man's need, you shall make your count for the lamb. Your lamb shall be without blemish, a male of the first year, and you may take it from the sheep or from the goats. Now you shall keep it until the 14th day of the same month, and the whole assembly of the congregation of Israel shall kill it at twilight. And so we see here the idea this lamb was to be set aside, and it says he was to be set aside on the 10th day. Had to be a male, had to be without blemish, had to be of the first year. Continuing on in verse 7. And they shall take some of the blood, put it on the two doorposts and on the lintel of the houses where they eat it. And so now we're seeing they've killed the lamb, and it says you're to take the blood, you're to smear it on the sides, on the top of their doorway. Verses 8 and 9 now. Then they shall eat the flesh on that night, roasted in fire with unleavened bread and with bitter herbs, they shall eat it. Do not eat it raw, nor boiled at all with water, but roast it in fire, its head with its legs and its entrails. So now the people are to eat the lamb. It's been killed. They've now spread the blood on the side of the doors. They are now to eat the lamb. Continuing on, verse 10. You shall let none of it remain until morning. What remains until morning you shall burn with fire. And thus you shall eat it, with a belt on your waist, sandals on your feet, staff in your hand. So you shall eat it in haste. It is the Lord's Passover. For I will pass through the land of Egypt on that night, will strike all the firstborn in the land of Egypt, both man and beast, and against all the gods of Egypt I will execute judgment. I am the Lord. Now the blood shall be a sign for you on the houses where you are. And when I see the blood, I will pass over you, and the plague shall not be on you to destroy you when I strike the land of Egypt. So this day shall be to you a memorial, and you shall keep it as a feast to the Lord throughout all of your generations. You shall keep it as a feast by an everlasting ordinance. A memorial. A memorial is where you're looking back on something, in remembrance, if you will. So they were to take this lesson, this ceremony, they were to pass it along to future generations. And it was to be that memorial, that remembrance to them of when that death angel passed over them. That was the nation of Israel. Drop down to verse 21. And Moses called for the elders of Israel, and he said to them, pick out, take lambs for yourselves according to your families, and kill the Passover lamb. Notice here, the lamb is now referred to the Passover lamb. So we're given it a definition, if you will, here. Continue on, verse 22 through 28. You shall take a bunch of hyssop, dip it in the blood that is in the basin, strike the lintel and the two doorposts with the blood that is in the basin. None of you shall go out of the door of his house until morning. For the Lord will pass through and strike the Egyptians. And when he sees the blood on the lintel on the two doorposts, the Lord will pass over the door, not allow the destroyer to come into your house to strike you. You shall observe this thing as an ordinance for you, your sons, forever. And it will come to pass that when you come to the land which the Lord will give you, just as he promised, that you shall keep this service. And it shall be when your children say to you, what do you mean by this service? That you say, it is the Passover sacrifice of the Lord, who passed over the houses of the children of Israel in Egypt, when he struck the Egyptians and delivered our household. So the people bowed their heads and they worshipped. The children of Israel went away and did so, just as the Lord had commanded Moses and Aaron, so they did. So Israel trusted God, didn't they? They believed God. And because they believed, they did what God asked them to do. You know, on one hand, that would have been, you're stepping out against the Egyptians, aren't you? And it would have been pretty easy to see who had done this, because your door is still covered with blood. So it took an element of faith for them to go ahead and to do this, to trust God through Moses, through Abraham, or through Aaron. And that's how the first Passover went. They did exactly as they were told to do. The death angel came and passed over all those that had their doorways covered in blood. You know, I don't need to go through all of that in detail. But we know then that the Pharaoh told them at that point to leave Egypt, get out. And as they left, they plundered Egypt. They took from them. The people were willing to give them their wealth just to get rid of them. And we're told that Israel came out with a high hand. And that didn't last too long. There was that incident at the Red Sea. God provided that miraculous escape for the children of Israel. At the same time, he destroyed probably the most mighty army on the face of the earth at that time, the Egyptian army. And then you find several weeks later, the children of Israel were then camped at Mount Sinai. And it was here at Mount Sinai that God then entered into another covenant agreement with, which was now called the nation of Israel, the children of Israel. Now this agreement, this covenant was different than the one that God had made with Abraham. The most important difference is this was a national covenant, included a nation. Wasn't just with any one individual or the family of one individual. It included an entire nation. This nation, or this agreement, was based upon the model of a kingdom. Now, I've talked about it before. A kingdom requires four elements. A kingdom requires a leader, a ruler. It includes, secondly, those to be ruled, the subjects of that kingdom. The third thing it includes are rules, or laws, if you will, how you live. The fourth thing you require is territory. So in this case, the ruler was God. The subjects, those being ruled, was that nation of Israel. The laws that were to be used were those that God was to give them, his commandments, his laws, his statutes, his judgments. And there was to be land, to be territory. That was yet promised. It was called the Promised Land. So the terms of the agreement, very basically, were this. You, the subjects, those being ruled, are to obey me, the God, your king. You are to live within the bounds of the laws that I give you, and I will protect you. I will bless you, and I will move you into the territory that I've promised. And yet, if you, as the subjects, refuse to obey me as the king, then you're going to be punished. In other words, I will not protect you. I will not bless you. So they were given that choice. And as we know, they made the wrong choice, didn't they? Time after time. They wandered in the wilderness for 40 years. And after 40 years, after that first generation had finally died off, we find where the children of Israel are about to enter into the Promised Land. And that's where you get up then to the book of Deuteronomy. And in Deuteronomy, you find where Moses reviews again with them before they go in and take the land. He reviews again this agreement that God made with them at Sinai. And we see where Moses' instruction included then a modification for how they were to keep the Passover. So let's look at that. Let's look at the change that is now made to the Passover in Deuteronomy. Deuteronomy 16, verses 1 through 7. Deuteronomy 16, starting at verse 1. In my Bible, the heading here says, the Passover reviewed. So not only is he reviewing it with them, we're going to see where he tweaks it or changes it just a bit. Starting in verse 1, observe the month of Abib, the first month. Keep the Passover to the Lord your God. In the month of Abib, the Lord your God brought you out of Egypt by night. So that remains the same. Therefore you shall sacrifice a Passover to the Lord your God from the flock and the herd and the place that the Lord chooses to put his name. You shall eat no leavened bread in it. 7 days you shall eat unleavened bread with it. That is the bread of affliction. For you came out of the land of Egypt in haste, that you may remember the day in which you came out of the land of Egypt all the days of your life. And no leaven shall be seen among you in all your territory for 7 days. Nor shall any of the meat which you sacrifice the first day at twilight remain overnight until morning. You shall not sacrifice the Passover within any of your gates which the Lord your God gives you. But at the place where the Lord your God chooses to make his name abide, there you shall sacrifice a Passover at twilight, at the going down of the sun, at the time you came out of Egypt. And you shall roast and eat it in the place where the Lord your God chooses, and in the morning you shall turn and go to your tents. Did you notice a change in here? How he changed something? And what we're seeing is, as the children of Israel are poised to go into the promised land, into the land of Canaan, they're ready to inherit that fourth element that God promised them, that territory. They were ready to truly become that kingdom, the kingdom on the world stage. And so to reflect their status as a full-fledged nation, you now truly had the king, you truly now had the subject, you had the laws, and now actual territory. And as part of that, then, the rules have changed. Passover is now changed. It is now to be celebrated in a central location. It is to be celebrated by the entire nation in the place or places that God places his name. It was God who was decide where they were to come. And so they had to travel now to keep the Passover. And you read through that, first of all, it was kept at Shiloh, and then finally later on in Jerusalem. And so we see this change. You know, the elements of Passover still remain the same, but now you have a change of location. You are to go to where God tells you to go to sacrifice that lamb. And so we've gone through now the original Passover, and we've seen how it's changed here in Deuteronomy. The changes that we just saw, they reflect a basic change from an individual observance to a national observance. It draws everybody together. And so now we're ready to go and look at the New Covenant Passover. So these final changes for Passover is what became, you know, we're rolled into, or the beginning of the New Covenant Passover. And what we're going to see is, when Christ instituted these changes, you're going to have a further modification to what was brought out in the original Passover. So these modifications were made, they reflect how God was dealing with humanity now. He wasn't dealing now with an individual, he wasn't dealing with a nation, he's now dealing with humanity. And so what we're going to see is, it moves from being a nationalistic observance to one that now can be celebrated by all of humanity. So we're seeing a progression, if you will, of the scope of this festival. Starts out with the individual, moves on a national level. Now we're going for all of humanity. And so some elements were added to the Passover. Some elements were removed, and we'll look into those. But God's plan, his purpose, has now moved forward. It has taken a step. We see that Christ had come. God would no longer restrict his work to Israel only. So the meaning has now expanded. So these modifications, they weren't put in place by people. Somebody just had a bright, intelligent idea and decided to change things. No, it wasn't even done by the church. These changes were made by Jesus Christ himself. And so as Christ and his disciples are eating that final Passover, Christ went through the modifications with them. Like I said earlier, they went through the traditional Jewish meal first. And so Christ, he has them all there. He does this in person. And we see where his disciples recorded it, and then they passed it along. And those are the changes that we have for, you know, in place for us today. And we're going to go through these, but in some of the letters to the churches, we're going to find where some of the apostles, then, they bring out additional spiritual insights to this pattern. But see, the basic pattern is going to remain the same that Christ gave us. There were then some additional things added to it. People today criticize a Passover observance as being Jewish, as meant only for the Jews. It was something that originated in the Old Covenant, and we know that Christ did away with the Old Covenant, right? But that's simply not the case. Because today we follow the very same pattern that Jesus Christ gave us himself in the year 2022. Let's go to Luke 22 now. Luke 22 and verse 1. Luke 22 and verse 1. Just want to read verse 1 for right now. It says, "Now the feast of unleavened bread drew near, which is called Passover." So I want to notice here a conundrum, if you will, right away. Apparently this was also a conundrum, if you will, that existed during that day. It's one that still exists today. And that is, when do you keep the Passover? When do you keep the days of unleavened bread? And these 2 days, they're special festivals of God, and they are kept back to back. You have the Passover, you have the days of unleavened bread. And what you find is these 2 days, these two celebrations, tend to get mushed together. You know, most people consider the days, consider the Passover and the days of unleavened bread to be a single unit. The Jews do that today. That's mostly how they observe it. You know, they keep the festival, they call it Passover. We would call it the days of unleavened bread. But they call it Passover. And they begin the first night of Passover with that Seder meal, which should be the meal for Passover. So they mush it all together, call it one festival, and they call it Passover. Now, you think of other things. I mean, today we're going to do a baptism. You know, a baptism has that same kind of conundrum to it. It's actually two separate celebrations combined into one. Because you have the baptism, you have the laying on of hands. They are two separate things. They have two separate meanings. And yet we always kind of combine them together under baptism. And so the Passover festival, it's separate. It is to be distinct from the days of unleavened bread. Hold your place here. Well, let's go back to Leviticus 23. Leviticus 23, it's made quite plain for us. Leviticus 23, verses 4 through 8. Leviticus 23 is where the feast of God are laid out for us. Let's notice, starting in verse 4, about, it says, Passover and unleavened bread. They're not the same thing. These are the feasts of the Lord, holy convocations, which you shall proclaim at their appointed times. On the 14th day of the first month at twilight is the Lord's Passover. On the 14th day. Very next verse. On the 15th day of the same month is the feast of unleavened bread to the Lord. 7 days you shall eat unleavened bread. On the first day you shall have a holy convocation, shall do no customary work on it. But you shall offer an offering made by fire to the Lord for 7 days. The seventh day shall be a holy convocation, you shall do no customary work on it. Now the Passover, the days of unleavened bread, they're related, closely related. But notice here they're clearly shown again to be different. They are not the same thing. Passover is to be twilight on the 14th. Feast of unleavened bread begins on the 15th. They're two separate events. It's very clear here. At the Exodus, you know, at that Passover, the people were first of all spared from death, weren't they? When that angel passed over them because they smeared the blood on their doorposts. They were saved from that destroyer angel when it went through the land. And it killed the firstborn of the Egyptians. And then after that, you had the days of unleavened bread. As we saw last week, that represented them being pulled out of bondage, drawn out of slavery in Egypt, to be led into a new way of living, a way of living before God. That's what that pictured. They were to be set apart by God for this special purpose. We went through that last week. And so that is different. The meaning is different than that of Passover. And so you still have that relationship of Passover to the days of unleavened bread today. And we see where they are still separate. They are similar. They still have distinct meanings, but they have parallel relationships. You could say it could be a relationship between justification and salvation. Justification and salvation. Again, two distinct and separate events. When you accept Jesus Christ as your personal Savior, you are justified. And then through baptism, you're redeemed from that death penalty. That death penalty of sin that you've had hanging over you. And then you are released from that bondage of sin. To live, supposedly, you're to try to live a way that no longer believes in sin, wants to stay away from that. You're now set apart. You are now sanctified by God. And it's a journey that we do for the rest of our lives. Two separate things. And we can also consider the same sort of thing with the Feast of Tabernacles. And we include the eighth day. You know, we do have a separate festival called the eighth day or the last great day. That is the final holy day of the year. You know, when we go to the feast, don't we? We always, that's how we talk about it. We go to the feast. We know that there are two separate festivals. We know that they have separate meanings. We know that they're very distinct. And even though we know that, it's kind of a mental shorthand, isn't it? We just always include the last great day as part of the feast when we're talking about the feast. So it's that same kind of mental shorthand, if you will, that Luke is talking about back in Luke 22. So let's go back to Luke 22. And so even though they're mentioned as the days of unleavened bread and Passover, we know that they are two distinct events. Let's look at verse 7 now, Luke 22, verse 7. Then came the days of unleavened bread when the Passover must be killed. So again, we're combining the two. You know, it's the same analogy I just gave with the feast and the last great day. But they realize that it is two distinct events. So the Passover was to begin that evening. And what you see is that Christ gave them these instructions. And it would have been sometime during the day then, daylight portion of the 13th of Abib. You know, if we were to put that in, you know, this year's vernacular, and it wasn't the same, but I mean, if you look at it on this year, I mean, Passover, the twilight of the 14th is on a Thursday evening. So sometime during the day on Thursday, the 13th, Christ would have given them these instructions. And then at twilight, when the sun went down, it would have begun the 14th of Abib. It was that evening that the Passover lamb was to be slain. Exactly like we read in Exodus when we looked at that example. Let's continue on, verses 8 through 16. And so he sent Peter and John, saying, "Go and prepare the Passover for us, that we may eat." So they said to him, "Where do you want us to prepare?" I mean, that's a natural question. Okay. How do we do that, in other words? Verse 10, and he said to them, "Behold, when you have entered the city, a man will meet you carrying a pitcher of water. Follow him into the house in which he enters." Now, do you imagine, can you just picture, here you have Peter and John there walking toward the city, looking for a man with a pitcher of water, looking for a man with a pitcher of water. There's a man with a pitcher of water. Is that the man with the pitcher of water? So they're looking for that. And they found this man. And then you shall say to the master of the house, "The teacher says to you, where is the guest room where I may eat the Passover with my disciples?" And he will show you a large furnished upper room. There make ready. And they went and they found it just as he had said to them. And they prepared the Passover. This is the traditional Passover meal, if you will, that the Jews normally kept. You know, with all the accoutrements and everything, they were to be ready. Verse 14, the hour had come, he sat down, the 12 apostles with him, and he said to them, "With fervent desire I have desired to eat this Passover with you before I suffer. For I say to you, I will no longer eat of it until it is fulfilled in the kingdom of God." Notice that Jesus Christ is very, very obvious here, isn't it? what they were preparing for, what he was sending them to do, what they were to participate in, was a Passover service. Let's continue on, verse 17. And then he took the cup. He gave thanks and he said, "Take this, divide it among yourselves, for I say to you, I will not drink of the fruit of the vine until the kingdom of God comes." And he took the bread, he gave thanks, he broke it, gave it to them, saying, "This is my body, which was given for me. Do this in remembrance of me." Likewise, he took the cup after supper, saying, "This cup is the new covenant in my blood, which is shed for you." So now, after they had eaten their traditional Jewish Passover service, Christ now puts in place a new service. The roasted lamb, the bitter herbs, are now being replaced with bread and wine. Sacrificing the life of a lamb as a substitute for his own life, for our life, for the sins that we've committed, is no longer necessary. That's what it represented in the Old Covenant. So why is that? It's because the sacrifice of Christ's perfect, unblemished life would from that point forward serve as a substitute, as a replacement for that lamb. That was, at that point, his life was the only sacrifice that was necessary. It would take place once, but it would apply to all people for all time. Sacrificed lamb was no longer necessary, because what the lamb pictured, what it looked forward to, was now being fulfilled by Jesus Christ. So when you think about the role of the lamb, as it related back to Exodus, that Passover, or to the Deuteronomy Passover, and then look at it in the New Covenant Passover. See, in the Exodus Passover, you had the slaying of a lamb so that the death angel would pass over them. It saved their physical life, but it had a meaning that pointed forward. And so we see in Deuteronomy, that Passover, where the slaying of a lamb was a memorial to the people, to remember, to look back, and to remember the Exodus. And now we come to what you could call a game-changing event. Jesus Christ is now sacrificed for our sins as our Passover. See, in those first two Passover models, you know, they were just symbolic. The death of a lamb, of a mere animal, cannot in any way pay the price for the sins of a human being. That blood cannot wipe away your sins. It's because animal lives are not at all on the same level as human lives. The book of Hebrews goes through that in quite some detail. So the lamb, in effect, was only a placeholder for that real death of Jesus Christ that would come in the future, at some future time in human history. And the death of Jesus Christ was that event, was that future event. It was a real death. It wasn't a symbol, it wasn't a sign of something yet to come. And so now you have the New Covenant Passover. Let's go now to 1 Corinthians 5 and verse 7. 1 Corinthians 5 and verse 7. It says, "Therefore, purge out the old leaven, that you may be a new lump, since you are truly unleavened. Why? For indeed Christ, our Passover, was sacrificed for us." Remember earlier we had seen where that lamb was called the Passover. Now, Jesus Christ is our Passover lamb. Now that the real thing has happened in human history some 2,000 years ago, we don't need that symbol. We don't need that placeholder anymore. You know, something that it looks forward to. That has already happened. That sacrificial lamb, that symbol, was no longer necessary. Therefore, a change was made in how we observe the Passover. So Jesus' own words put into place these new symbols that he gave to us. The bread, the wine, The bread symbolizing his body. The wine symbolizing his blood. And we'll rehearse that again this year. So from that point forward, again, the Passover is to be formed as a memorial, something that you're looking back and remembering, that memorial of the death of Jesus Christ. We're looking back to that actual historical event that occurred. And again, we're seeing how through that death, God's plan has now moved forward. And you picture that throughout the rest of the Holy Day cycle. But you have to set that foundation first. So how are these changes to be put into place? You know, Paul, when he was addressing the church in his first letter to Corinth, when you read through there, he wasn't pleased. We'll just put it that way. He was not pleased with them, was he? He admonished them on several different issues. He wanted them to change their ways on several different things. We looked at some of that last week. But in the middle of that, he inserts something there that helps us better to understand the New Covenant Passover. And again, you have to remember he's talking primarily to a Gentile church. These are not Jewish people. They had no background with the children of Israel. They had no tie to the children of Israel. No history that where they came out of the land of Egypt to remember. That wasn't there. See, that history, the Jewish history, that was foreign to them. We're in 1 Corinthians. Go to chapter 11, verse 20 through 22. Here it's called, you'll see in here, the Lord's Supper, but that's not, it is talking about the Passover here. Verse 20, therefore, when you come together in one place, it is not to eat the Lord's Supper. For in eating, each one takes his own supper ahead of others. One is hungry, another one is drunk. What, do you not have houses to eat and drink in? Or do you despise the church of God and shame those that have nothing? What shall I say to you? Shall I praise you in this? I shall not praise you. So what you see at that point in time is you had members that were making a show of Passover. The wealthy had food. They had wine, apparently to excess. And it says in there, you had some of the poor had nothing. So there was this hierarchy within the church. You know, where the wealthy stood out above the poor, and it's on full display here. Paul's having none of it. There's no way I'm going to praise you for that. Verse 33 and 34. Therefore, my brethren, when you come together to eat, wait for one another. But if anyone is hungry, let him eat at home, lest you come together for judgment. And the rest I shall set in order when I come. So Paul, in effect, he's telling them, you no longer have to have a meal as part of Passover. See, there is no lamb. Now, Christ himself, he didn't specifically abolish or do away with the meal. And apparently here you see where the church has some traditions surrounding that meal. These traditions that they were following, perhaps, you know, some Jewish traditions, they were obviously adding in their own thoughts into it. And they've blown it way out of proportion. And what's Paul saying? He's saying that meal is not a part of the ceremony. If you're hungry, eat before you come. Let's go back up to verse 23 through 26. It says, for I received from the Lord that which I also delivered to you. And you remember, Paul was trained specifically by Jesus Christ. That the Lord Jesus, on the same night in which he was betrayed, took bread. And when he had given thanks, he broke it, and he said, take, eat, this is my body, which is broken for you. Do this in remembrance of me. In the same manner, he also took the cup after supper, saying, this cup is the new covenant in my blood. Do this as often as you drink it in remembrance of me. For as often as you eat this bread and drink this cup, you proclaim the Lord's death until he comes. Notice here what Paul goes back to, this pattern that Jesus Christ had established on taking the bread and wine. And Paul is saying, I got that directly from Jesus Christ. I wasn't at you know, that first Passover there, that new Passover, the new covenant Passover, but he taught me. Notice he tells them they need to keep it on the very same night that Jesus was portrayed. You know, there are many professing Christians, and you look at this, and this the bread and the wine is something out there in religious circles that's known as the Eucharist. And many Christians get caught up in this phrase where it says, as often as you take the bread and the wine, you know, that then do this in remembrance of me. And they catch hold of that phrase. For example, the Catholics perform this Eucharist every time they do Mass. If you've ever been to a Catholic service, they do it. You know, they have everybody files up there, and you get your little wafer, and you take a little sip of wine. Other denominations will do it weekly. Others do it monthly. Others do it quarterly. Others do it yearly. It's all over the place. Do some research on the Eucharist. It gets really convoluted, messy. But what does Paul say? Paul gives us the answer. On the same night that he was betrayed. In other words, the 14th of Abib. Remember again, Paul's audience. These were not Jews that had come out of the world. These were Gentiles. So he's teaching this new covenant Passover model, the way of observing it, to people that were not Jews. You know, if there was any opportunity to change it, to do away with it, this would have been a perfect time to do it. But he didn't do that. He reinforced it. In other words, he's saying this new covenant Passover is meant for the followers of Jesus Christ. This is not a Jewish ceremony. That's what he's telling them. Jews today, as I'd mentioned before, they eat this specific meal called a Seder. There are specific foods that are eaten. You know, they had the lamb, they have the bitter herbs, they do different things. You know, and you look at all of it, and it is, on one level, it's quite fascinating to see what they do. Certain rituals are performed. There are spiritual readings that take place at certain times. It's very orchestrated. It's very meticulous. Seder meal. But it's not what Jesus Christ taught. And it's not something we follow today. It's not our desire to keep strictly the Old Testament Passover. Instead, we keep the Passover as Jesus Christ instituted it. So I've gone through all of this, but perhaps you've noticed in here one step that we perform as part of our Passover service that I haven't brought up yet, and that's the foot washing. So in keeping with this desire to follow the pattern that Jesus Christ gave us, our service also includes a ceremonial foot washing. Let's go to the book of John. Book of John. John 13. John 13, verses 3 through 5. John 13, starting in verse 3. And Jesus, knowing that the Father had given all things into his hands, and that he had come from God and he was going to God, he rose from supper, laid aside his garments, took a towel, girded himself. And after that, he poured water into a basin. He began to wash the disciples' feet and to wipe them with the towel from which he was girded. And so you have this foot washing. And this was also an element that was introduced by Jesus Christ. And I won't read through the rest of it, but we're familiar. You know, he came to Peter, and Peter wanted to deny Jesus Christ that opportunity to wash his feet. Oh, no, you're not washing my feet. And then when Christ said, I have to wash your feet, what did Peter do? He jumped from one ditch to the other. In that case, wash all of me. Very much the way Peter was, and when you look at the life of Peter. Let's go down, though. Let's pick it up in verse 12. Verses 12 through 17. So when he had washed their feet, taken his garments, sat down again, he said to them, now he's going to give them the lesson. He performed the task, and now this is the lesson involved. Do you know that what I have done to you? You call me teacher and Lord, and you say, well, for so I am. If I then, your Lord and teacher, have washed your feet, you also ought to wash one another's feet. For I have given you an example that you should do as I have done to you. Most assuredly, I say to you, a servant is not greater than his master, nor is he who is sent greater than he who sent him. If you know these things, blessed are you if you do them. At that point in time, foot washing was a sign of hospitality. You know, you graciously went and you washed someone's feet. Generally, that was a task that was signed to the lowest servant or slave even. It was dirty work. And yet, what do we see? We see Jesus Christ once again willing to lower himself to that level, the very lowest level. And he says we are to take heed of that example. We are to emulate what he did. So washing feet as part of the New Covenant Passover is a very strong reminder for us. We should also be that humble servant. Whether it's a small task or a large task, we should be willing to serve. So before we begin the Passover, before we begin the Holy Day cycle for yet another year, the first thing that we are to be reminded of is that we have to be in the proper mindset. We have to be that humble servant. We have to be willing to wash someone's feet. Christian life is a life of service. It must be with this foot washing attitude. As we know, there was no foot washing in the Exodus example we saw, nor in the example in Deuteronomy. There was no wine in those models either, when you look at them. So these are new elements for a new Passover observance. They were put into place by Jesus Christ himself in the flesh. Don't get any more authoritative than that, do you? You got your marching orders directly from the source. So in conclusion, the Passover is not just an Old Testament or Old Covenant ceremony. As we see, it is thoroughly part of the New Covenant and how it's to be observed, that it has a spiritual significance for those that consider themselves the followers of Christ. It's not a national, it's not a cultural celebration. It doesn't reflect on the Jewish people. See, the meaning of the day was changed by God himself in the person of Jesus Christ. He gave us that example himself. Passover is now a remembrance of a personal redemption of each and every person who becomes a disciple, who chooses to follow Jesus Christ. So the Lamb of the Exodus and Deuteronomy, those Passover, it looked forward in anticipation to the actual event of that true sacrifice of the true Lamb of God, and that was Jesus Christ. That Lamb came, and he died. It was a real, it was an actual event in human history. That Lamb was, that Lamb still is, Jesus Christ. He gave us a new way of observing the Passover. It's 100% biblical, and it's ours. It's ours as a memorial to remember always the sacrifice of Jesus Christ. Hope you have an enjoyable Passover this week.